You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After weeks of secrecy, Senate Republicans released the texts of their draft health care bill this morning. As legislators debate the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, policy uncertainty and the threat of no health coverage for millions of Americans have exacerbated the problems of a health care system that's been overrun by organizations seeking to exploit patients for profits. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, joins us now for the latest installment in our series on health care and the future of the Affordable Care Act to talk about what's in the proposed Republican plan known as the American Health Care Act, the AHCA, and what it means for patients and health care costs. I'm very pleased to welcome Elizabeth Rosenthal back to our show. And we also invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. The number here is 212-433-9692. Do you have questions about navigating the healthcare system in the future? And are you dealing with doctor bills, high prescription drug costs, etc.? Give us a call, 212-433-9692. Elizabeth, have you been able to read this new draft?
Well, we're parsing it as it's come out, but I think we understand the essentials of it now. So on a first pass, we have a pretty good sense of how it differs from the House bill and how it might impact our health care.
And how different is it? How long is it, first of all?
I haven't counted pages. It's
but it's long. A long one?
Yeah, it is.
But you say it is different? Conceptually,
well,
or just in detail?
No, it's different mostly in the detail. I think they promised that it would be very different than the version that the House passed. But in fact, much of it is quite similar, at least philosophically. It moves the numbers around a bit on different issues to please an attempt to please the moderates and to some extent the conservatives, tries to hand out a little bit to everyone. So, for example, it keeps many of the things that people were concerned about with the House bill, such as the Medicaid, rolling back the Medicaid expansion that happened under the ACA, but it has a somewhat different timetable, which is a little more, shall we say, sensitive and nice hard in the beginning, but then becomes more severe as the time goes on. So, you know, it's you know, I think what Senator McConnell and his group of framers were doing in this bill is to try to thread a needle with a very, very small hole to get all of his fellow Republican senators on board, because he's going to need them to get this moving anywhere.
A conservative website has already weighed in with its criticism, calling the Senate's version cosmetic surgery on Obamacare. It says it certainly does not repeal it.
Well, that's true. You know, it does keep some of the the infrastructure of Obamacare, but it, you know, I think anyone who favored Obamacare would say it instead of just doing away with Obamacare, it essentially pulled out all the teeth. So, you know, it now gives states the option of not offering a set of essential benefits that were defined by Obamacare. It allows states to charge higher premiums to those with pre-existing conditions if they so choose. It takes away the penalty for not having insurance. It allows employers to not be penalized if they don't offer insurance to their employees. So while Obamacare, structurally, is many parts of it are still there, the teeth and the financing for it are effectively removed. So you know, this is something that probably will not please many of the far-right conservatives and will certainly not please those who favored the ACA.
I understand it's 142 pages.
Yeah.
Now, one of the big issues is Medicaid. Last week, Larry Leavitt, the senior VP of Kaiser Family Foundation, was on our show to discuss the future of the Affordable Care Act, and he noted that The most far-reaching part of the proposed AHCA plan is to restructure Medicaid, which currently covers tens of millions of poor or disabled Americans, including millions who are living in nursing homes with conditions like Alzheimer's or the after effects of a stroke. How would those people be affected by this proposed legislation?
Well, very severely. I mean, we know, first of all, there was the Medicaid expansion, right? So we had tens of millions of new people on Medicaid who were ineligible before the ACA. So all of those people will eventually not be able to get even Medicaid. And they're, frankly, many of them probably too poor to afford much of anything else on the exchanges, especially with the new possibilities of higher rates.
Would the AHCA cut back on federal government's contributions to Medicaid, leaving it up to the states to make up the difference?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's an essential part of what this bill does, is to say, to kick it back to the states, say, okay, you expanded Medicaid. That was your choice under the ACA. And remember, a lot of the states that expanded Medicaid were red states. So this is going to affect Republican governors. So yes, it's you want to keep offering these benefits, great, but you foot the bill. And guess what? That's going to be a huge problem for the states because they can't. You know, these are really big ticket items that they're drug treatment, maternity care, those kind of things that are not, you know, little costs around the margin. But the other thing it does, of course, is for the people who have long been on Medicaid, it also pulls back their benefits. It tries to rein in the benefits, saying that Medicaid spending will henceforth be capped, and the cap will not increase as fast as Medicaid spending has increased. You know, the Senate and the House bills vary a bit on that timetable, but you know, everything is kicking things back to the state. So I think that's why you see a lot of even red state governors really, really worried about what they're seeing coming down.
And
remember, this is in the middle of an opioid epidemic where much of that treatment is covered by Medicaid. And also remember, as you referred to, a huge portion of nursing home care in our country is covered by Medicaid, even for people like you and me, even for people who formerly had insurance, but as they're living longer and spending down their assets in this world of very high-priced care, they eventually in nursing homes rely on Medicaid. And what are we going to do about them? I don't think we have a good answer right now.
The Senate bill defunds Planned Parenthood for 1 year. That would mean Medicaid patients could no longer seek treatment at Planned Parenthood clinics. And an article in today's Times notes that abortion could complicate passage of the AHCA. The House version would bar the use of federal tax credits that help purchase insurance plans that include coverage for abortion.
Well, yeah, this is where the hole in the needle that they're trying to thread is really, really, really maybe invisible, but really small. You know, there's the pro-life faction of the Republican Party that demands these kind of provisions in the bill. You'll note as we tried to do a kind of photo gallery of who was writing the bill, who was that secret panel, they all have 100% rating from the Right to Life people. So you know where they stand. But I think for many of the more moderate Republicans, these kind of provisions are going to be a really hard sell in their home states. Plus, I think the added question is, will these provisions about defunding Planned Parenthood and abortion rights make it to the Senate floor, to the Senate vote? They're passing this new health care bill under something called budget reconciliation. So the parliamentarian of the Senate has to decide that these provisions are primarily budget provisions. And you know, I think all of us rationally know that's not what this is about. This is not really about the budget for these two provisions. So whether that will even be allowed to remain in the Senate bill when it goes through the parliamentarian, which has to happen before the vote next week, is a big question.
The Tea Party patriots have put out a call to action for their supporters. And one of their concerns is the cost of Obamacare. How successful was the Affordable Care Act in reining in patient health care costs?
Well, I think, you know, I feel like a broken record on this in some ways. You know, no health policy will work very well when we are paying 2 to 3 times the prices and the costs of every other country for our health care. I mean, that's an essential problem that no side has faced very directly.
Well, why wasn't it able to control what you describe as runaway spending?
Well, it tried. I mean, first of all, it needed for passage buy-in from the groups like the Hospital Association, the American Hospital Association, the health insurers groups, the American Medical Association. So some of the early provisions that were in the ACA had to be removed to get buy-in from the groups who were involved. And it tried very, very hard to control costs indirectly. So to do things like to bundle payments, give hospitals a set payment for things like a hip replacement that was lower than the average that they're currently spending, and to try and make it work that way. And it did, you know, there are mixed reviews on how much it accomplished in that vein. I mean, again, indirect approaches in a very complicated industry with a lot of for-profit players tend to be not very successful. So it did what it could. And I would note that the current administration is undoing many of those kind of looking for value proposals that were in the ACA. So I think what we saw with the ACA was, in the end, it covered a lot more people, which was really good, so they weren't going to emergency rooms. It gave a lot of people premium support, you know, to help paying those premiums as they were going up. So it really helped those people. But for a certain range of upper, I would say middle class to upper middle class people who were buying on the private market, on the insurance exchanges, they weren't getting premium support. Their premiums were skyrocketing. Their deductibles were skyrocketing, as they have been for all of us. You know, this wasn't a problem inherent to the ACA. But the ACA didn't give a solution to those people. And they often, as we've seen, that group faced premiums in some states that were just, they meant their insurance was effectively not usable because it was so expensive to even walk into a hospital door.
As you point out, with very high deductibles, what happened to the health insurance cooperatives that were formed by this ACA? Why didn't they succeed?
Well, again, this is one of the Obamacare's noble efforts that, you know, they failed sometimes because, you know, some would say the Republicans tried to push it under the bus, and some would say because it tried to turn things around a little too quickly. So these were not-for-profit insurers that were started in a large number of states, I think two to three dozen. Very few of them survived more than a year or two. That was partly because Congress never gave them a pot of money that was promised to them that might have allowed them to live through those first turbulent years of learning how to be an insurer, of learning who is going to sign up for the ACA policies. That was a little bit uncertain. I mean, the other thing is, you know, the kind of more structural big problem is these were mostly little guys trying to compete against the bigs. You know, we have 5 huge insurers. And when you're trying to negotiate with hospitals, if you're a little insurance cooperative, you don't quite have the muscle and the insurance and the negotiating power that Cigna or Aetna or the Blues have. And so, you know, you're kind of starting off as a little guy, not very well funded, and you're not in a good position to demand what you need. So, you know, I think many of us had high hopes for that idea. Some are still surviving. I think they're under 10, but they are there still. And maybe that will be a model for our future. I don't know.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, author of An American Sickness, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, author of An American Sickness. The plan was just released today. Why is the Senate Republican leadership determined to vote on it by the end of this month?
Because they go on recess. And, you know, this was a promise that we were going to deal with repealing and replacing Obamacare. And they want to get on to tax reform. So I think they feel like they need a win. So many of them and the president have run on, you know, we're going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something better that gives better care at for less money. And of course, as we're seeing now, that's a really hard Rubik's Cube to put together. And so I think they just want to say they did something.
In your book, In American Sickness, you wrote, even the well-intentioned provisions that managed to survive the torturous congressional negotiations over the ACA have been in practice diluted and perverted as providers find ways to maximize revenue by gaming its rules. How have the providers been able to circumvent the ACA's rules?
Well, and I will say that this is not the typical provider, I hope. You know, I think those essential health benefits were really important, you know, that maternity care has to be an insurance, that, you know, if people want them, a physical has to be an insurance. But what we saw, I mean, one that preventive screening services have to be covered by insurance. So what you see, the classic one that I hear about a lot is, okay, you go in for a preventive colonoscopy, something we know is good at detecting early cancer, colon cancer that can be treated. And that's supposed to be covered at no cost by any insurance policy. But guess what? Then you discover that they find a polyp, right? And instead of counting as preventive, then it becomes a diagnostic colonoscopy, and suddenly you're on the hook for the whole thing, which in our country can be $4,000, $5,000, $6,000. So there's this gaming of coding. And of course, the whole point of having a screening colonoscopy is if you can find something and treat it, you're avoiding cancer. So that's a really great thing. So I guess it's kind of a bizarre construct that it's only preventive if you don't find anything. Likewise for those physical exams that were guaranteed, what I hear from people is the physical will be free and then the doctor will send off, you know, 10 different blood tests that cost hundreds of dollars, which, oh, guess what? That's not included in your physical, so you have to pay those.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but on that, you write, in New York State, vitamin D tests can vary between $7 and $700.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of bait and switch that went on with those essential health benefits that, and a lot of gaming of, okay, you know, ACA, you're going to make me do this physical for whatever the insurer wants to pay or do this colonoscopy for a negotiated rate, but I'm going to get back my money by figuring out ways to kind of work around the system, kind of a, you know, Hail Mary pass. So
some of the past laws also presented problems. How was Medicare Part D, which was signed into law by President George W. Bush in 2006, an indicator of how the medical industry could manipulate health care legislation?
Well, you know, it was, I mean, the ironic thing is, originally, Medicare didn't have drug coverage because drugs used to be really cheap and no one thought, well, you know, no one's not going to be able to afford those, so we don't need to have that included in insurance. But then, of course, they got more and more expensive and seniors were not taking their medicines around 2000. And so under the George W. Bush administration, there was Medicare Part D was passed to give seniors some help with insurance with drug coverage. And, you know, initially it worked pretty well because you had some prescription drug coverage. The way it worked was you had to pay a copay for the first, I think, a few thousand dollars. Then you entered something called the donut hole where you were on your own. But if you made it through the donut hole, which was a few thousand dollars, it meant that you really needed that drug, that you were willing to put your skin in the game, as we like to call it. And then after that, when it got up above that limit, you ended up with full coverage for as much as you needed. The problem was that as drugs became more and more expensive, right now everyone ends up in the donut hole pretty much. And, you know, a few thousand dollars for your, like, run-of-the-mill blood pressure pill is unsupportable for a lot of people. So we ended up with the ACA trying to close that donut hole, saying, okay, seniors, now we're going to cover more and more and more of those costs. It is not closed yet. There was a target to close it within a few years. But in the meantime, now, instead of being for the exceptional senior who had very high drug costs, who would face that donut hole and endure it because those were really needed drugs, now it applies to so many people that it's essentially not a drug benefit at all, I think.
In a recent op-ed for the New York Times headed, "We All Have a Pre-Existing Condition," you wrote yeah. that the Republican bill raises a very basic issue. Who will decide what constitutes a pre-existing condition? Before the ACA, what were some pre-existing conditions that could be used to deny a person insurance coverage?
Allergies, you know, history of a questionable pap smear, mild asthma. You know, I think I went through when I wrote that piece and said, wow, I'm basically a really healthy person. I run. I haven't been in a hospital for, you know, I haven't had any medical needs for years, really. But I, by the accounting that was in place before the ACA that many insurers used, I have a number of pre-existing conditions. You know, once a year I use an asthma inhaler. I'd been on an antidepressant for a period in my life. I had one more. Oh, I've had an abnormal pap smear when I was much younger, you know, decades ago. But that would, an insurer could say, oh, you're high risk, you're pre-existing condition, and then charge me premiums that were through the roof. Now, the new
Republican and some of the bill. Other things that you listed in that article, C-section, yeah. sexual assault, domestic violence,
yeah.
they don't sound to me like pre-existing conditions. A C-section? You have two choices when you give birth.
I had one of those, too. So, you know, that was the point of writing that article, that basically what were called pre-existing medical conditions, that had been dumbed down to, like, just life. You know, something happens to everyone. And so, you know, basically everyone was at risk for being thrown into that high-risk pool or being denied insurance. Now, the new bill doesn't allow states, as I understand it, to actually deny insurance. But what it does do, which is effectively the same thing, is to say you can charge people with pre-existing conditions higher rates than the average person, you know, whatever that is, which the ACA didn't allow. So if you say people with pre-existing conditions are going to be charged five times what the usual rate is for insurance, you're effectively saying to them, we're not going to insure you.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, author of An American Sickness. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What's a community rating waiver?
Well, this is part of what we were talking about before. Community rating means you have to charge everyone who gets insurance, either the same rate or stipulated, like maybe you'll allow people who are older to be charged somewhat higher. But there are standards for how much you can charge based on the fact that we all need insurance. We all have different medical needs. And some of us who are really healthy today may be really sick tomorrow. So it behooves us when we're really healthy to help pay in for some of those who are really sick, because you never know when you're going to be the one who needs it. Community rating waivers, which are included in the new bill, allow states to do away with that and to essentially cherry pick by deciding to charge people who are older or who have medical needs way, way, way more, and so much more that essentially, like I said, insurance becomes affordable. It becomes a theoretical possibility rather than something that you have and that you can use.
In An American Sickness, you wrote about the high cost of patient complacency. Have yeah. Americans become resigned to the fact that healthcare is expensive? Because medical debt is the single biggest cause yeah. of bankruptcy in the United States.
Well, you know, when I wrote the book, which came out in April, I was writing in 2016. And yes, I mean, the book is in some ways a call to arms to say to patients, hey, you know, you've accepted this. You open these bills, you think, wow, that's crazy. you negotiate, you may pay them because your insurer is taking the big brunt of the hit, but we can no longer say it's nuts, but I can't do anything about it. We have to become noisy. We have to push back and say, why does it cost so much? And we have to demand more of our political representatives to address this problem in a direct way. And I think what we are seeing now, which I think is really different than maybe a couple of years ago, you look at those town hall meetings, right? People are not complacent. Some of the representatives are afraid to go in front of their constituents now. And what are people standing up and screaming about? It's healthcare. You know, what is the issue for Americans now? It's healthcare, because I think with these high deductible and high premium, high copayment plans, which we all face in and out of the ACA plans, this is not an ACA issue. People are seeing, you know, in their living rooms and their kitchens that I can't afford healthcare anymore. I can't go on a vacation this year because I'm spending $24,000 a year, and that's like, you know, a quarter or a third of my household income just on health insurance and some minor things. What happens if I get cancer or if something really bad happens? People are realizing, I think, as a result of the last election and hearing about some of these proposals, the rolling back of Medicaid, the Medicaid expansion, the risk of people with pre-existing conditions once again being terrified of not being able to get insurance. I think people are starting to stand up and say, wait, this is not okay. Now, are our representatives listening? I don't get a sense that they are yet.
Although they are concerned, according to Paul Ryan, the problem is that if this bill fails because of conservative opposition, it will be deemed a failure of President Trump, or worse yet, a failure by Senate conservatives. So not a Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan failure.
Well, I think, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around, right? You know, the essential failure is that we our politicians and this patient complacency have allowed this inflationary cycle to take place in healthcare, so that none of these plans are affordable, and none of them take very good care of us if we don't want to be bankrupted, unless we have, you know, super duper Cadillac insurance. And you know, I feel incredibly lucky that I have good insurance right now, because I would not want to have to be shopping around the way most Americans have to do to manage their healthcare costs. And hey, I'm a physician. I cover healthcare. I you know, I'm sitting here between Capitol Hill and the White House. I'm like as informed, I think, as you could get, and it's terrifying to me.
Last month, you wrote an open letter that was published on Medium to physicians who have asked how they can better protect their patients from excessive charges. Are most doctors even aware of the charges at the X-ray centers, the labs, and facilities to which they refer their patients?
No, I think they're not. And, you know, I don't want to blame them for that. This is, you know, many have told me, oh, well, I went to my hospital and said, how much is OR time cost here? How much are you charging for an ER visit? And the hospital won't tell them. So they're like, they're in kind of the same mode as the patient. Like, this is awful, but what can I do? And I guess my message is, look, patients have power. Doctors have a certain power because they are essentially the purchasers of healthcare, right? They're the ones who say, I'm going to write a requisition for an X-ray. And now, unfortunately, I think they need for us as patients to go that extra step and say, okay, there are 10 X-ray centers within a mile of my office. Which one does a good job at a cheap rate? You know, because that doctor knows who performs good X-rays. I don't, maybe. So I want my doctor to send me to an X-ray facility that does a good job for a good price. And I want him even more to say to the one who's charging, you know, literally $700 for that vitamin D test or $1,000 for a knee X-ray, I'm not going to refer my patients to you anymore because you're ripping them off. So, and I think we're seeing more and more of this, doctors at a leadership level, people who are really into this kind of patient-physician space, saying we have to be better advocates, not just for health, but for our patients' pocketbooks, because it is really depressing. And there's one surgeon in the book who kind of came around as, and into this role because he took out someone's appendix. He's a general surgeon in a conservative part of Wisconsin, and the guy came in and said, you know, thanks, doc, I'm better, but did you know I got this $40,000 hospital bill I can't pay? And he said, I realized I'd saved his life but bankrupted his family. Now, no doctor feels good about that.
A New York Times, yesterday was the deadline for insurers to file marketplace premiums for 2018. And a New York Times analysis earlier this month found that about 45% of U.S. counties are expected to have zero or just one insurer in the ACA marketplaces, which would leave about 12 million people with little or no choice for insurance in the federal exchanges. Anthem just announced that it's dropping out of two more states. Would insurers return if the AHCA is passed?
Well, it's possible. You know, their narrative has been not that we don't like either plan, but that we can't operate with uncertainty. You know, they're trying to do actuarial calculations, not knowing what the law will be and what the requirements will be. So, yeah, it's totally possible more will come in. I saw a senator this morning suggesting, which is an interesting idea, these are called bear counties, you know, ones that have no and are potentially have no insurance. Maybe people in bear counties should be allowed to join the exchange that members of Congress use to buy their health insurance. That's an interesting, novel idea. Maybe we should say in bear counties, people could buy into Medicare or Medicaid. Those proposals have been raised both nationally and at a state level. So there are solutions. But we have to start addressing them. And that's partly what the book is about. Like, there are solutions to many of our problems. But as we sit around and debate and do nothing, the problems just get worse.
According to a New York Times study, Medicaid covers 64% of nursing home residents, 60% of children with disabilities, 49% of births, 20% of all Americans. We will be seeing major changes, I assume, if these new bills are passed. If they are not, I have no idea what's going to happen. Will the ACA remain in effect, or will something else develop just as a matter of course? We will continue following this story with Elizabeth Rosenthal. Elizabeth, it's always a pleasure having you on our show.
Oh, thanks for having me. And I this discussion will continue, I'm sure, for a number of months. Years? I hope not.
We'll be seeing you again. Elizabeth Rosenthal is editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, author of An American Sickness.